The Off the Ball Podcast Network.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Now then, you're very welcome back. So we are reviewing the Sunday Papers. We are joined in studio by an All-Ireland winner with the Dublin Footballers, a two-time All-Star, and now in a coaching capacity working with the Dublin Hurlers, Cliona O'Connor. And we have journalist David Snaid as well. You're both very welcome.
Hello.
I'll get into the back pages and then we'll get stuck in. There's lots of good stuff in the papers today. So lots, as you might imagine, ahead of Liverpool against Manchester City. Pep, I'm never the underdog. City boss Guardiola ready to bite back in fight for title on the back page of the Star. We have the Sun. Boasting in an interview inside with Michael Conlon, which we'll touch on. He's talking to Kevin Byrne. And then again, Liverpool, Man City, we're out to get you. Sterling, time for City to end the Kop jinx, where Manchester City have won just once since 1981, and that was 16 years ago as well. Sunday Mirror, we've no fear. This is Virgil van Dijk. Virgil van Dijk tells champions, we don't panic, and we have the quality to win every game we play. Van Dijk saying that the Champions League win in June has given them a new sense of self and confidence. The Sunday Times main section, which generally just means there's an FAI story. This one, not so juicy, or one that we'll have to spend too much time on. But Mark Tyher reports that John Delaney will face Sunday Times legal costs case. So the Sunday Times is to take action against John Delaney to recover legal costs that the paper incurred when they opposed the former FAI chief executive's injunction back in March. So the costs, they reckon, are in the region of €27,000, smaller than typical High Court injunction hearings because the paper used an in-house solicitor. But nonetheless, they're going to go after John Delaney for those costs. The Sunday Times sports section has Leicester on the back page after their win again. Last night, they're flying, they're up to second. It's a picture of James Maddison and Jamie Vardy, both who scored yesterday. Class apart, Leinster soar up to second, leaving Sorry Gunners 9 points in their wake. Then we have the Sunday Independent. The mess in Mayo continues. So, Mayo chiefs summoned by headquarters. It seems, according to Shane Phelan, the Mayo County Board has been summoned to a meeting with senior GAA officials to discuss, frankly, what the hell is going on. And then beneath that, Guardiola relishing Anfield challenge. Back page of the Mail. We'll touch on this story. Actually, this is kind of interesting. Stephen Kenny. Stephen Kenny hits out at, quote, grossly insufficient funding. This is Philip Quinn. So Stephen Kenny, I mean, you might have seen the under-21s have to take three flights to Armenia, which is ridiculous. But Stephen Kenny has talked about government and their grossly insufficient funding of Irish football. He says it's alarming compared to other sports in the country. We'll come to that in just 1 second. So Stephen Kenny, I mean, rather than kind of looking at the FAI and how the game's been run, is going after the government here. And then, well, Manchester United fans might look on and enjoy this one. This is on the front page of the Racing Post. It's Alex Ferguson looking fit and healthy. Another trophy in the bag for Sir Alex. This was at Wincanton yesterday, where Give Me a Copper won. And there's a picture there of Alex Ferguson looking very happy afterwards. And then finally, Sunday World. Picture of Jurgen Klopp, one step beyond. They're a step ahead, says Jurgen Klopp of Manchester City, and we are the ones with space for improvement. So they are your back pages. David, this Stephen Kenny story here on the back page of the Mail on Sunday. Incoming Ireland manager Stephen Kenny says Philip Quinn has lashed the government for grossly insufficient funding of Irish football, which he believes is alarming when compared to other sports. This was on the back of being asked, obviously, about the under-21s having to take three flights to get over to Armenia because the money isn't there to charter a flight, presumably. And he says, of the state, for me, it's always the biggest issue in Irish football, the lack of government funding. It's been alarming over a number of years, the lack of investment in infrastructure. We see other sports get stadiums, facilities, they appear everywhere. And considering football is the most played game in the world at grassroots level, I think the funding is grossly insufficient to start with, never mind the money that's being withheld. And he talked about a few other things. So, I mean, it's very hard to argue against the funding of anything, really. So, you know, in theory, yes, let's give everybody and every pursuit as much money as possible. But given over the last 10 years that the FAI have received almost 50 million, 49.448 million to be exact, 50 million in funding from the state, and that's included capital projects, that's included money for grassroots. You know, the Department of Sport, or the Department of Children even gave 2.8 million in 2012 as an example for summer camps and things like this. Given the way the FAI has been run, I think most people will look at Stephen Kenny's comments and say, if you think another cent of taxpayers' money should go near the FAI, you are deluded. I like that.
It's just the time. It's the timing of it. It just doesn't, like, he was dead right during the week to kind of speak up about the flights issue. The fact that, for people who don't know, the Ireland 21s and a qualifier, they're in Armenia on Tuesday. Rather than getting a charter flight, they have to take three flights to get there. And so he's well within his rights to complain about that and bring that issue up. And quite strange, I think his predecessor might not have been so forthcoming to have been so critical or to have brought the issue to light. He could have very easily swept it under the carpet. Mm. Like, I know what you're saying about the 50 million. Like, well, I think what he's trying to get at is in terms of especially League of Ireland structures, but also grassroots, maybe more could have been done. But
whose responsibility was that?
I know. And that's the issue. Like, when you see the revelations that have been happening over the last number of months, I don't think now is the time to be kind of critical of, say, funding that has been there. Mm. You kind of, in a strange way, you're almost glad it hasn't been there, because God knows what would have actually happened to it. Like, you saw the story in yesterday's Irish Independent, Dan McDonald had issues there with the Football for All, and there's kind of questions that need to be answered with that about kind of actual money that was put forward by the government, and yet the full amount wasn't disclosed by John Delaney in the FAI. So,
it's sort of something that
Kenny will have to kind of get used to now. The fact that when he says something like this, it's going to be on the back page. It's in the, he would have spoke to the Sundays, because it's in the Sun as well. Just, I don't think it's in the back of the Sun though. Like, when he speaks now, he's the incoming Ireland manager. Mm. When he speaks, people are going to listen. It's going to have a lot more profile.
There's probably another question about funding though, and it's always an argument in every sport. You've got the elite level and you've got the grassroots level. So the government may have funded, what did you say there, 2.6?
But that was just a random example in a random year, but they have given, in effect, 50 million over the last decade. Yeah. Now, again, they could give more, of course they could.
Yeah.
But I don't think the issue with any ills at grassroots level now can be laid squarely at the government's feet. You know, for anyone, the burning issue is how the FAI has run the game.
Yeah. And there's two different elements. There's always of the elite performers, of getting a charter flight, those that under 21 team, the senior squad, what do we need to put in place for them to be the best they can be? But also, where's the priority? So do you put more money into the development of the game? Do you put more money into your elite performance? And people have different opinions on that. Mm. I think, broadly speaking, the way the FAI has managed itself over the past number of years probably hasn't served either end particularly well. Mm. And that's the issue. And you're right with Stephen. He's now in a position where people care what he has to say, and people are listening a lot more intently to his opinion on everything.
Yeah, and that's it. I don't know, even from dealing with him as the manager of Dundalk, he's always very upfront. And if he has something to say, he'll say it to you, you know. And hopefully he doesn't curb those instincts, but it's one of those things that he'll now find is, if he says something like this, it's going to maybe start a debate a little bit. Mm. Like, separate to the fact, the timing of it, I think, it doesn't sit right. Well, people, as you say, people will read it and be like, what's been going on for the last night? What are you talking about? But there is a point in the sense that, like, he mentions, say, Daly Mount Park, the fact that it's coming up, this, like, going to be redeveloped. But then that's still a work in progress. And that was one project that John Delaney trumpeted before his departure. But that was essentially, that was kind of the FAI working in tandem with a club and also with Dublin City Council. And there is a point there that needs to be made, in the sense that going forward, if there's not going to be proper private investment in League of Ireland clubs to kind of bring things forward, that's what it has to be. It has to be multifaceted, in the sense that it has to be kind of local government working with the clubs and with the FAI. And going forward, that's essentially what you would hope to like. Like, he does make good points here about kind of, like, you've always had hard working people running. Sorry, this is Stephen Kenny. Mm. You've always had hard working people running the clubs, but there is a new dynamic to be welcomed now with Peak Six coming into Dundalk in the last year. So that's obviously the American investment firm. You've got Dermot Desmond, that's Shamrock Rovers. So that's going to be very interesting now. Like, he's pumping in, like, significant money to start with the youth structures there, which is going to be. That could be a game changer for Rovers, especially if he gets involved in Irish football. And then the Garda Kelleher, who's been at St. Pat's. On the issue with Garda Kelleher and St. Pat's, like, this comes back to, like, St. Pat's only a few months ago brought through a proposal to help re-energise really area of Inchicore, St. Michael's, to stay with Garda Kelleher, who had private investment coming in, was going to be providing, say, social housing and a lot of kind of facilities in this area, and yet literally was
snowballing,
essentially. Yeah. It just wasn't going to happen, and that's an issue that has to change in terms of, because like, obviously you have Dermot Desmond there coming to the role, which is great. You're not going to, unless there is an incentive for private people to come in and inject money, it's not going to happen. So you have to be smart about it, and it has to be an element of working together. So the FAI is going to be going through some big changes, you would imagine, now over the next few months. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that will, in the long term, lead to kind of better kind of working structures between kind of different bodies and the League of Ireland clubs, because over the last God knows how many years, this has probably been a debate that's happened over the last 30, 40 years. There just hasn't been a proper working relationship.
Yeah. I mean, I would agree with you. I wouldn't like to see the new job curb Stephen Kenny's comments, because often he makes these brilliant interjections about a whole range of issues, footballing, social and otherwise. Mm. But maybe just on this one, the elephant in the room here is the FAI, and maybe that should be to the fore when you're talking about what's gone on. But look, does every sport need more funding? Absolutely. We'll come back to football in a few moments' time. So there's a Peter Reid interview, which is really good, actually. Peter Reid's a character, and a bit of Man City-Liverpool build-up as well. But we were talking, Cliona, and you were picking out various pieces which kind of come under one broad umbrella of what it takes at elite-level sport. And we have some very different pieces here. So Tyson Fury has done an interview in the Sunday Times magazine, which is kind of must read. You have to read this interview for a few different reasons. Tommy Conlon is writing about Katie Taylor, and then there's a piece on Mary Kane, who was with Alberto Salazar and Nike and has come forward with the New York Times during the week. So where do we want to start on all that? Well, the Tyson Fury one will take us a couple of minutes to get into. So maybe Taylor. Tommy Conlon's writing about Katie Taylor in the Sunday Independent, and really making the point that her achievements are brilliant in so many ways, but the depth in the professional ranks is an issue.
Yeah, it was funny. I read this, and to be honest, immediately I had a definite negative reaction to the piece, you know, and you're trying to... Is it just because we all love Katie Taylor and we can't possibly say anything bad about her? I'm not sure, but it was just very strange. You know, he's talking about... Yes, she's great, and she was a trailblazer in terms of her drive for women's boxing in the Olympics, and that was all wonderful. And back when she started that, she was better than everyone else, and she went on to prove that. And then she goes and moves into the professional ranks, and he's talking about how basically everybody else isn't particularly good. Some of them aren't full-time athletes. He mentions one fighter who didn't even make weight, and then so he sort of, I suppose, questioning the credibility of what she's doing, I felt, anyway, which it didn't really sit well with me, because so what if she's better than everyone else? That's why she is winning. And, you know, he makes a comment about they were so one-sided that perhaps they didn't require any training at all. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe they're one-sided because she trains harder than everyone else. You know, what is she supposed to do? Lower her standards because the professional boxers that she's fighting against aren't as good? To me, she's doing exactly what she did in the amateur ranks. She's raising the standard of women's boxing, professional women's boxing. And I don't know, it just felt that he was judging that or criticising that. And
but is he criticising her, or is he more criticising professional women's boxing? Because he does absolutely clearly state, obviously, the champ herself does not have a credibility problem.
Yeah.
So he says that in the clearest possible terms. She doesn't have a credibility problem, but it remains what he says is an unavoidable reality that the business she's in does. The pool of talent that Taylor has to navigate is about as deep as a puddle. In the pro game, most of her opponents have been farcically amateurish. And he says the challenge for her management from day one has not been to avoid dangerous opponents, but actually to avoid opponents that she would endanger. And later on, he goes on to make the point that really the defeat of Persoon, which was her one really tough fight up until the most recent one, that brought Taylor her fourth World Championship belt. In truth, says Tommy, she would have swapped them all for the Olympic gold in Rio. And then he says, while the world's elite amateurs have been preparing intensively for Tokyo, Taylor's been fighting part-time professionals who wouldn't lace the gloves of the aforementioned amateurs.
Yeah, like...
is that not a fair point?
It's a fair point. Yeah. Go on, Dave.
No, like, from a point of view of a columnist, he's done his job perfectly in the sense that it provokes a reaction when you read it and he gets you thinking. I would have the same opinion as Cliona. I disagree. I didn't sit right with me. Like, this, it's a well-worn argument. It always seems to be about Katie Taylor where, oh, well, she's up against rubbish. Like, she got women's boxing into the Olympics. And ever since then, like, even through that, it's always been, oh, yeah, she's good, but You know what I mean? And it's almost this, there has to be an asterisk against her because, like, she is a trailblazer. So you're talking here, she's like, the line, as you mentioned it earlier about kind of how the pool of talent that Katie Taylor has to navigate is about as deep as a puddle. That could be the Leinster Championship in men's football. You know what I mean? So you're going to start slagging off the Dubs with the hockey and everyone. Like, it's the exact same. There's no difference, you know what I mean? And
but that doesn't not make it true. I mean, you could slag off the Leinster Championship next week and both could be true.
Yeah, I know, but like, but that does that lesson, say, does that lesson say Katie Taylor's achievements as a pro boxer now?
Well, that's the interesting
question,
yeah.
He's saying the champ herself doesn't have a credibility problem, but then you can't go and slaughter the competition without kind of actually drawing that conclusion.
Mm. What if it's true, though?
Well, if it's true, well, hand on heart, I'm not a big boxing fan, so like I can't go into the details of give you a kind of great depth on who she has been fighting and all the rest of it. But
either can I, by the way, for the record.
Yeah, right. But and so and fairness now, if Tommy has gone through all this and he is an expert, he can go well, hold me hands up. But it just didn't sit right. And then when it gets to the last paragraph, the last section of it, I'm sort of thinking, like, you've literally wrote, the whole piece has been about one thing, and then right at the end, talk about like a sucker punch.
So people obviously haven't read the piece potentially. So like, explain.
Like, do you want me to read it out, or?
Well, just for people if they're listening, I think
so
in fairness to Tommy,
he goes through it all, and like as I said, as a columnist, he's done his job perfectly, and that's great. And then he just finishes up by saying, 15 weeks at camp in Connecticut means a lot of time alone in our apartment there with our Bible," which that just I didn't really like that. When the road work and the gym work are done for the day, it's a solitary existence for a 33-year-old. She's been doing it for so long that it could be seen as something more than a way of life, actually a form of escape from life or an avoidance of conventional society. As if the champ is not so much running incessantly towards an endless horizon of future targets, but away from our present or our past. It's a great finishing paragraph, like in terms of writing. Mm. It's good, but just didn't sit right with me when I read it. He's making assumptions there about the woman's life, and
you didn't like the psychological diagnosis from across the pond.
Yeah, like, you know what I mean. It'd be different. You know what? It'd be different if this was a 4,000-word piece where he's followed her for a year to this training camp, and has a proper in-depth knowledge of what's going through her head, and can actually, with authority, write that. You've got a responsibility as a columnist when you're writing about something like that, and to go from everything else and then to just finish with that, bad form, in my opinion.
To be honest, it's for me, it's the most problematic paragraph. For, you know, what you're saying, David, is true, but also from, like, of course it's solitary. Like, she's an elite athlete. What is she expected to do? She is trying to raise the standard in professional boxing. She trains unbelievably hard. She's so diligent in her preparation. And to swing it, like, that's what I mean, there's a negative connotation to this whole description of how she carries herself. Now, I don't claim to know Katie Taylor at all, but I do know a couple of my friends would have played soccer, like, university level with her. And, you know, you ask them, what's Katie Taylor like? And they'd immediately say, and it's always stuck with me, say, you always knew with Katie she'd do something phenomenal. She just had that personality. But that's what it takes. That's what it takes if you're going to do what she's done, if you're going to be an international trailblazer. It does take living a non-conventional life and not living the normal life like the rest of us do. Yeah. And that's not a negative, but that's what it takes at international elite level. And that's the reality of it. It doesn't mean you're always running away from something or it's a negative thing. Well, it is an escape, though.
Well, I mean, of course it's an escape, but I mean,
sport is in general, you know what I mean?
Life isn't so hot for the rest of us either. Get up, go to work, come home, cook a rubbish dinner, rinse, wash, repeat, you know?
I'm boiling me water for the last 4 days. Can't even have a little cup of water from the tap. But, like, it's, as I said, from a professional point of view, the column, it gets you talking and it gets you thinking and it provokes a reaction, and that's exactly what you want, but it doesn't mean you have to agree with it.
It totally does.
Or like, and
no. Tommy will be the first person to say that, I suspect.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
But he's done his job here.
He does back up the argument about the depth of boxers that Katie is coming up against. Like, for instance, without reading the whole thing out, and you should check it out yourself, it'll be in the paper or on the website later on, I'm sure. He talks about, you know, when Katie won her first belt. He says, as if to demonstrate the shabby circumstances, the fighter she was fighting against failed to make weight, thereby handing the title to Taylor before a punch had been thrown. Taylor's next opponent was a full-time investment banker. The one after that was an accounts manager. And the one after that, a 37-year-old mother. The reason he mentions she's a mother is that at one stage she took 4 years out from having twins in her career. And he says Rose Valente from Brazil then held the WBO version of the belt. Her previous title defence had been against a Colombian who was nearly 42 years of age. He says it wasn't until the Delphine Persoon fight that Taylor finally met with an opponent with whom she was evenly matched. So he doesn't just throw it out there. He does go through some of the opponents,
but
to be fair to him.
You're right, it is true. I mean, she is significantly better than her opponents. But then the question that follows that isn't, well, then she's obviously doing it for another reason, to escape something. Maybe she's just doing it because she wants to raise the standard in professional boxing and because she loves boxing.
And her amateur career in the Olympics, like, it didn't end. Like, it ended on a bad note in terms of, like, how she got beaten and stuff. And maybe that was just, like, she conquered a mountain, like, in the amateur game. Like, there was nothing else for her to do. She's gone in now to, like, she dragged women's boxing in terms of, again, this is just from me reading down through the years, like, it wouldn't be in the Olympics if it wasn't for Katie Taylor, you know? And so you're reading this, and then you have in the Sun, page 40 and 41 in the Sun, then you have the interview with Michael Conlon, with Kevin Bourne. And you have then the fact that Michael Conlon's talking about how Katie Taylor is now is inspiring the next generation of amateur and professional female boxers. So, like...
But again, they're not mutually exclusive points. She can be doing that, and at the same time, because she is the trailblazer, the current depth in her era is not up to scratch, but it will get better. And in 100 years, it'll be phenomenal. Yeah. And people will look back and say, geez, Katie Taylor played a big role in that. They're not mutually exclusive things, are they?
You know, they're not. But, like, if we're talking about the depth of talent, right? Like, and I'm going back to Gaelic on this, and again, but, like, the Dubs have been dominant in the All Ireland, right? Mm-hmm. And he mentions there some of the fighters he fought against their professions, but, like, the Galads are all, I know they're amateur, but it's essentially professional in terms of what the work they do. But would you say there's a depth of talent then in the GAA at the moment?
I suspect Tommy Wood.
Yeah, well, all right, but then I'm looking forward to reading that column. So.
I suspect he's written about it before.
Like, I'm looking for, maybe he has, probably haven't read it though. But, like, I don't know, I think it's something that's always been thrown at Katie Taylor.
Okay, okay.
And I just think it's something that could have just been plucked from
maybe
drafts.
Maybe it's
final word, Lena,
Well, maybe we're running out of things to talk about Katie Taylor because she's so good and she's dominating. And we're looking for something, we're looking for another angle, etc. Just because she's better than everyone else doesn't mean that it means less to her or that she's doing it for a different reason other than to be the best boxer she can be.
Tyson Fury, front page of the Sunday Times. This is must read, I think.
Yeah.
She has been interviewed by Deka Atkinhead. I'm not overly familiar with Deka's work personally, but she sits down with Tyson Fury, who seems to have a new memoir out. And I don't think it goes especially well, this interview. So, look, she charts a lot of his career. You know, at the age of 10, he'd left school, worked with his dad, dealing cars, collecting scrap, carrying bricks. Age of 20, he married Paris, an 18-year-old from another traveller family, turned professional. Talks about his rise to beating Vladimir Klitschko. Within hours of his victory, plunged into depression, 28 stone. I think we're familiar with the story at this stage. Mentions his series of what she calls breathtakingly ill-advised public outbursts, attacking gays and Jews, joking about, quote, excuse the language, kids in the car. I won't say that line. Later said, woman's best place is in the kitchen and on her back. So, you know, not his best period, to say the least. Tested positive for a prescribed steroid in 2016, came close to taking his own life, and gave lots of quotes that he gave to Rolling Stone magazine at the time about his cocaine use. And then she charts the comeback 12 months later. You know, the world had written him off, but he's world champion again, lost 10 stone, £80 million deal with the ESPN, the Deontay Wilder fight, and so on. Everybody, I think, is fairly familiar with Fury's story. At one point in the interview, she's interviewing him about various things, and she says of sitting down with him, I thought I'd have to listen to him talk about boxing, but thankfully I really didn't, because he got into his personal stuff. But anyway, she says from the off, radical candor is Fury's new thing, and so deceptively disarming, I mistake it at first for raw authenticity. But then she goes on to say, quite soon though, I begin to suspect his new candor is just as theatrical as his old showmanship. I'm not even sure Fury would know the truth if it hit him in the face. And then she goes on to, as an example, say to him that she asked him about his bipolar disorder. But he says to her, but I don't have bipolar. That's something you don't know. And she says, but I just read that diagnosis from you in your own book. And he says, well, I don't have a book out, so you can't have. And she says, I'm here to interview you about the book. So you don't know what's going on here. He's obviously, yeah. I, you know, to draw the boxing parallel, he's dancing around the ring a little bit, and it goes from there. That's the general mood of this interview.
Yeah, I think even reading it, you're a little bit kind of uncomfortable, shifting in your seat a little bit, and you do get that sense that she doesn't know what's happening, he doesn't really know what's happening, and it's a bit all over the place, to be honest.
Did you enjoy it?
I did, because you're trying to figure out where is it all going to end? Where is it going to go? You know, are they going to have a cup of tea, or what's going to happen?
Yeah.
At the start, like, there's two things that jumped in. Like, in the second paragraph, she's talking about how he comes in wearing a silk Versace suit and white linen trousers, and he said, yeah, but I've created a monster, haven't I? I created this flamboyant character, so now if I don't turn up dressed the part, people are disappointed. It's a brand, it's just part of the job. Mm. And then towards the end, again, he talks about, you know, people want to see a freak show to sell papers and to sell views on TV. Before I was a performing monkey, I've done everything from A to Z to be famous, and it got me to where I wanted to be, that elevated position where every such and such knows who Tyson Fury is. Now I can be me. Mm. Now, there's two things. It's this constructed persona. Mm. I mean, that's what comes across, and he's probably jumping from one to the other. And the now I can be me, from reading this, you're like, well, you don't have a clue who you are, really. You know, that's what definitely jumps out at me. And I suppose the vulnerability in that. Mm. Like, he comes across to me as a really vulnerable individual. Mm. Yes, he's a boxer and he's a champion this and champion that, and probably lives on this adrenaline, stronger, bigger. He's got one of the biggest reach in boxing and all of this positive stuff. But to me, when you scratch the surface underneath it, he's really, really a vulnerable individual.
Mm. Remember, wasn't it the fight? I think it was his last fight when he won. And I'd imagine it's like after a match where maybe that's when you can be your most honest, when you kind of the guard maybe has slipped a little bit. I remember he came out and spoke really passionately about kind of mental health and the struggles he'd been through after one of his fights. And you got the sense that was maybe the real Tyson Fury. That's how he felt. And then, as Kenny was saying, where he's talking about, like, he's created this brand, so he's going in for an interview here. Like, this is what he has to be the showman. He has to be, like, he was putting her on edge there with the whole, I haven't got a book out.
Yeah.
Like, that's him kind of trying to see how she reacts and getting a feel. And
she says it cracks at times. Well. Because she writes, I don't think he's going to love this piece if he ever bothers to read it. Because she says on that point, you know, about if it's an act or what's not an act, she says, I don't think Fury really knows which parts of him are real or an act. He's a compulsive myth maker. When I ask him if he still feels the boxing world is prejudiced against him, for example, he's off. And then she has, you know, Fury's kind of, nothing can hold me back, I'm a one-man army, the Gypsy King will prevail, and on he goes. And she says, it's like watching a human scalectric set, roaring around familiar conversational tracks. But whenever a question derails him by requiring him to stop and think, I can practically see the wheels spinning to get him safely back on track. Yet more than once, I think I can see him boring himself. He feels most alive, if unsettled, when deviating from the script, is how she puts it. She also says, in the past, he's credited his recovery to God. For a while, in fact, he wouldn't shut up about God. But to my great relief, God's now on the list of things he refuses to talk about, probably because it's got him in trouble in the past. But then she goes on to talk about the things he won't talk about. And in fairness to Fury, I kind of like, he's dead right in certain instances. So she says the list includes my big fat gypsy wedding. I have no opinions on that, he says. The perils of social media, everyone to their own. His parents' violent marriage. Their business, not mine. And again, who wants to talk about that? And then she writes his father's numerous extramarital children, including one called Tommy, who starred in this year's Love Island. Fury closes that right down when I bring it up. Bloody right he did.
I mean, yeah. But I suppose that's the problem, isn't it, when you're dealing with somebody like this, who at some point in their career has engaged with all that and brought it on and used it to their own advantage, because maybe it served them at that point, and now is flipping to a different style. No, I can't talk about that anymore. And that's what I mean about the vulnerability piece. He's not really sure what he wants to talk about, or who he is, or and maybe part of it is when you're a boxer, you've got to get into a ring and fight somebody hand to hand combat. So that who you are when you step in the ring is going to be so important. And we saw that in the Michael Conlon piece as well. Like, who you are when you step in the ring is critical to how you perform. Yeah. And I think there's just so many lines of being blurred for him as an athlete and as a boxer.
Because she could have went here and interviewed him the next day and he could have spoken about all that stuff. You never know. He could have just decided, actually, no, this is what I'm going to speak about. And not that, it's her job in a way. If she wants to talk about that, to maybe get that out of them some other way. Like, you can be smart with that when you're interviewing someone, you know, yourself, where you can kind of like, I don't know, that kind of exchange where she's talking about the book and he's talking about, well, like,
what book?
I don't know how early that was in the actual meeting, but you kind of, when you're interviewing someone, you get a sense of what they're like and how to kind of, how you push their buttons without pushing their buttons, how to, if you know what I mean, where you don't have to be kind of combative with the interview. And but Cleaner's Right again is where, like, with him, like, his life just seems to have been so crazy, and his career and the last few, like, he seemed to be as if he was a goner a while ago, and it's been a resurrection. Like, he's come back and he's got himself kind of straight and he's got himself just kind of really focused and stuff, and he deserves a huge amount of credit for that. But that doesn't mean that still everything's grand with him, like, you know what I mean. It's clearly, as kind of saying, a very vulnerable fella, and but very intriguing fella as well, and interesting fella.
This kind of a little line as well between sports and performance and entertainment, and he's gone into wrestling and what are you?
What
are you,
is it?
Are,
it
you, are you a sports person? Really diligent? Are you a Katie Taylor type thing? Like, there's no doubt he's a hugely talented boxer. Or are you an entertainer? Or does he feel he has to be an entertainer to be a boxer?
Or what do you want to be?
Exactly. Yeah.
Because at one point, you know, he talks about how he hates doing media and hates doing all this stuff and, you know, no time for it. But she makes the observation, well, you've got a fortune estimated at 40 million and more to come. You don't actually need to do this then.
To a point.
A small bit of the ego as well would play into it, that someone's interested in going through it. And he has got a book to sell. But it is that whole, like, going back to what you're talking about with Katie Taylor and then with Tyson Fury about what each person needs to do to get themselves, like, the best out of themselves, be it whatever, like, sports people, but essentially a boxer. And then when you look at the piece with Michael Conlon and with Kevin Bourne in The Sun, it's very interesting in terms of what he's talking about. Like, he's got two young kids, his wife is obviously in Northern Ireland, but then he'll still want to be away from them when he's training because he doesn't want to be around them. Like, he wants to have that edge where he's isolated. Well, he's in London, so he's not, or he's in England, whereas he's in Surrey. So he's not, like, he's not in the depths of despair there. Like, it's a nice place, Surrey, but, like, he finds that he has to be away from them. He has to kind of have something else to drive him while he's kind of in that training, just to kind of get that extra bit out of him.
He was talking about preparing for being in camp, and he said, you know, being away feels like, it makes me feel like I'm in the zone. Whereas when you're at home, you're going home a lot and seeing your family, everything seems a bit too happy, too easy, when I kind of need to be in a military mindset, one where I'm wanting to be the best, so I know I have to make sacrifices. So again, just an interesting take, and a very honest take on saying, I need to feel like I'm going through a bit of hardship, that I'm away, that I'm sacrificing, rather than being home in the lovely environment with your wife and kids.
It's a good point as well. You think about it, like, he sort of almost needs, as you're saying, he needs that kind of, almost as if, well, why am I doing this? So by being away from his family, that's why I'm doing it, is for them. Where if he's around them, he sort of sees, well, like, he's probably made a few bob. Like, I think there's going to be a seventh fight in Madison Square Garden and stuff, but, like, he's probably got a comfortable enough life back in Northern Ireland, I would imagine. He's probably, like, probably, that's what he's thinking. But it's interesting as well, where, even just into the mindset of a boxer, where I would have always assumed, if you step into the ring, you have to be angry to be able to dig the head off someone. Right, but he says, I wouldn't say I'm a nasty, I'm guessing, like, be it's start out or anything like that. I know I can't go into the ring as an angry person, because if I go into the ring angry, I don't perform. That's not what I aim to do by doing this. What I aim to do by doing this is knowing that I have sacrificed and knowing that I have put it in. And that gives a real insight into kind of the boxer's mind, where you just have to almost, it's almost as if you have to stay at zen maybe to get into a ring, to actually just have that dead-eyed focus to be able to go up against another person and do what they do. And it explains, and going back to Katie Taylor, it explains why you need to have that maybe sense of isolation, where you have to just feel as if it's just me, I'm here now and that's it. Because, like, otherwise, if you're surrounded, I'm sure obviously you're in camp and you have different people, but if you're constantly surrounded by people and you see how great your life is, how are you gonna have that fire in your belly to win to a ring and actually want to fight? Like.
We're going to take a short break here on News Talk, and on the far side, Rob Daly and Brian Kerr are going to pick it up from Old Trafford, but we will continue the pay-per-view here on all our social channels, and you'll get it on podcast as well. There's lots we're going to get through over the next 20, 30 minutes. Neil Francis has written a big piece about the drug culture in South Africa, and he wonders, should there be an asterisk beside the 2019 World Cup? David Walsh is reporting from Team Sky, where things have got more bizarre. So that testosterone package that arrived in Manchester back in 2011, the latest thing they've dreamt up now is that it was ordered for Shane Sutton, one of the coaches there, to help with his erectile dysfunction, even though Shane Sutton denies having erectile dysfunction and testosterone is not a treatment for it anyway. But that is the latest story they seem to have come up with in the tribunal, so we'll touch on that. A very good interview with two Paralympic athletes and a few more bits besides Peter Reid as well, talking in the Sunday Independent. So we'll take a short break here. On the far side of News Talk, you'll get events from Old Trafford. And if you want to stick with us here on social media, we're going to get through the rest of those stories. So we can continue. Just before we wrap up on the Tyson Fury, Tommy Conlon on Katie Taylor part, Mary Kane was another aspect of that you wanted to just kind of draw in clean. It's I guess if we're going for the triangle here of different professional experiences.
Yeah.
Mary Kane did a brilliant video. I think a lot of people would have seen it on the New York Times during the week, where she went in as a 16-year-old wunderkid with Alberto Salazar. He said she was the best athlete in the world. He wanted her. And frankly, what she says was physical, emotional abuse ensued. She's now 23. She's been spat back out by the system. And nothing good came of it. And David Walsh is writing about it on the back page of the Sunday Times.
Yeah, it can probably tie it all up together, I'd say, in terms of elite sport is bloody hard.
Not good for you, really, in many ways.
Yeah, and the...
That's why I opted against it.
he had all the talent.
You thought better of it, yeah. But probably the other piece about the responsibility of the coach, because like, you're dealing with any of these ambitious athletes, especially if they're that young, like they will do anything. Mm. And that maybe ties in with a doping culture, etc. You can move into Neil Francis from that, but you have a responsibility then. But this, like this stuff, I watched her video as well. Like there was no nutritionist, so he was talking about weight, right? And said, here you go, take a few birth control pills and diuretics, when weight was such a big issue. And there's no nutritional support there.
Or she even get the sense? Medical people there.
No,
it was like Alberto and his mates kind of a thing.
Which is insane. Go to a GAA club, a Division 6 football team will have some nutritional guidelines. This is supposed to be one of the best sports performance places in the world. And it seems like an absolute joke, to be honest with you. And to me, that's an ego-driven coach with shortcuts. Ah, here, take a few of them pills and we're not actually going to do it properly. Address your body composition rather than whether you're fat or not.
And no sense of care for the athlete.
Absolutely not. Yeah. You know. And the thing of, I don't know whether it was in this or whether it was in the video, but, and he's saying, well, I always supported the welfare and troubled why it hasn't been raised before.
Yeah.
Because she's a child and she's trying to do everything she can to be the fastest female athlete in America. That's why.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And she has given over all of this, I suppose, trust to this coach because he's supposed to be the best in the world. And with that, he's just ruined it, you know?
I saw that video during the week and then I saw on Twitter and stuff a few kind of athletes who would have worked with her and one of them said, I can't remember her name now, but she said, she saw what was happening but thought it wasn't her place to actually say anything, you know what I mean? You sort of almost like a fear to actually stand up to these people and let's be honest, as you say, how can you
I think there's an element to Stockholm syndrome as well that must kick in because so the Nike have hit back and said, well, it was first we heard of it, and as you said, Salazar kind of said, well, where were you when you were, a couple of years ago?
Yeah.
And that she wanted even to get back in the program relatively recently. And she says that for many years the only thing I wanted in the world was the approval of Alberto Salazar. I still loved him. He was like a father to me, even like a god. I was constantly tormented by the conflict of wanting to be free from him, but also wanting to go back to the way things used to be. Like, I don't want to overplay the extent of her being a psychological victim, but there probably is that conflict.
Absolutely, absolutely. And sorry, if you're a proper coach with good ethics, and even I know he has loads of success, but if you're looking at a young athlete who is losing weight, self-harming, and running really poorly, running really poorly. She says herself she was brutal. Performance was brutal. Yeah. There's something wrong.
Even if you care about nothing else, but the fact that she's running poorly.
Yeah. Then you got to change your tack, you know?
She said in the video she told them after one really bad performance she did, it was self-harming.
Yeah.
And nothing was really done about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, but you'll always get that. You still see it in some context, that idea. Elite sport is tough. She's just not tough enough.
Mm.
Not tough enough. Which is bull. In my opinion.
When you're coming up, so do you get a sense that when you're kind of, as you're getting younger, you sort of think, well, these people know what I'm doing, I don't. You're kind of learning from
them.
Absolutely.
And you just sort of say, well, who am I to...
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, if Salazar tells you to lose weight,
Yeah.
It makes sense. You know, you can go, okay, I get that.
Yeah.
She made the point as well there were no female people in authority around. And look, sometimes I think discussions about gender, we reduce everything back to gender, and it's kind of not the case. But it was she made that observation that it was just a very male environment, and maybe they'd no appreciation to what it was doing, you know, not having a period, go on birth control, nobody for her to talk to.
Well, that's a whole other element to the body composition piece. Like, scientifically, body composition is entirely different for males and females. From a hormonal perspective and menstrual cycle, like, it is entirely different. Mm. And, like, females will always have higher fat content in their body than males. Like, the males will get leaner naturally. That's just the hormonal
biology,
makeup.
Yeah.
That's just biology, you know? Mm. And if you don't take that into consideration, and if you don't understand the knock-on effect of being too lean, mm-hmm. you know, for a female, then it might, like, stress fractures and long-term hormonal implications, you know? That maybe they're men. They never wasn't in their sphere. They don't have to deal with it themselves, and maybe they just didn't know, you know?
Mm. Like, it seems, when you read it and stuff, it's just like, get the best results possible as quickly as possible without actually properly going into a development plan for them. And as she said, she wasn't doing it. And then
well, that was the thing about the nutritionist that struck me. I was like, that's a shortcut. Yeah. Here, take diuretics. Shortcut, you know?
Which were also against some wider regulations as well, those diuretics.
Yeah. That doesn't really matter.
No, I mean, don't be so naive. Yeah. I mean, to even bring that up. Maybe, Alberta, this is against the rules.
Yeah.
Could you imagine even saying that to them? So, I mean, it's amazing, really. Like, Nike just kind of sauntering off. Oh, well, we'll close this down. I mean, give it 6 months and the new Nike Oregon project will emerge somewhere else.
Yeah, different name,
So it's kind of like, you can argue in some respects. Like, in many people's eyes, it's a toxic brand now, Nike. I'm sure they will disagree with that.
Yeah.
Absolutely, as is their want. But
take your runners off,
yeah. But what's gone on there is really, really grim. So they are our elite athlete section. We were doing Tyson Fury, Katie Taylor, and the Mary Kane experience. Wasn't it interesting by the Mary Kane video? So just by chance, I've seen it, you've seen it, you saw it. More people have seen that than I suspect they would have if she had done a traditional print interview.
Yeah.
It is an example of the way the world is changing.
Yeah. And it was a strong video and, you know, it was well done, actually.
Yeah. Meanwhile then, so Neil Francis, if we're staying along the Nike Oregon Project team for a moment. Neil Francis, page 6 of the Sunday Independent, a week on from South Africa winning the World Cup. He concludes the piece by asking, should there be an asterisk beside the 2019 World Cup? So how he gets there really is by detailing what he thinks has gone on in South African rugby. Just to give brief outlines, I know you found the explanation about how the various substances in Deontay's system work in tandem very interesting. So Francis starts off actually with a quote from Winnie Mandela. We talk of a rainbow nation in a country that is dichotomized between black and white. We must acknowledge that the rainbow is in fact still a dream. He says the woman who spoke these words would have had a better grasp of the realities of her native land than most of us who threw a cursory glance at the World Cup and the warm fuzzy feelings that enveloped proceedings last Saturday when South Africa, despite its myriad problems, prevailed. And I must say, I was in South Africa recently for a week and I was a bit shocked and dismayed at the extent to which I suppose segregation is the only word for it, is alive and well. It's an economic version as opposed to an apartheid version, but it was really incredibly striking in Cape Town. There were lots of pieces written in local papers there. I'd buy a paper and have a look, see what's going on in the area, and lots of pieces written about how really, black and white people are still living apart for all intents and purposes. There's a generation after generation just cycles of poverty, you know, which really things haven't changed in many respects over the years. So that kind of struck me when I was watching the narrative around the World Cup win and how it's great and we're all one nation and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, that's not ultimately the point of his piece. He starts by talking about Afua Gyanche, who is, he was the World Emerging Player of the Year in 2018. So, you know, the kind of star up-and-coming player of 2018. Tested positive on July 2nd.
Part of South Africa, isn't
he? Yeah, huh?
The Troy part of South Africa.
Something like that, yeah. Three substances in his system. And, he denied it, but they found the three substances. And what Neil Francis does for a good section of this piece is to detail that these aren't just three random substances. Mm. This didn't have the hallmarks of somebody who didn't know what they were doing, either going online or looking on a shelf somewhere and going, well, I'll try a bit of that and a bit of that and a bit of that.
That's a good explanation.
These were designed to work in tandem.
Yeah. It's very good. It from the it's almost out of the Colleen Rooney school of sleuthing, how he kind of just explains all this and how it breaks.
Is that the gold standard now?
That's the gold standard, without a doubt. No, it's very good. It is, like, we were chatting about this outside, and like, to all intents and purposes, you see a story about kind of rugby and doping and all the rest of it, and you start thinking, like, you have your fill of it, like, so much of it, because you sort of, like, from the outside looking in, you're sort of looking at the size of these fellas and what they put their bodies through, and you're sort of thinking, like, sometimes you need to take something just to be able to survive in this. Like, how did our bodies actually cope? But what was really good about this, as you mentioned, is the explanation of, it's not just three random drugs where he thinks, oh, I'll take this and I'll take that and I'll take that. Like, it's, and he wraps it in, it's kind of structured. It's like, there's definitely a seem to have been a plan here for him in terms of, this is what you do, this is why you do it. And when you read it, you can get the technical aspects of it. Sometimes you read that, you might kind of find it hard to digest.
Well, generally,
whereas this, it's very good. He does it very well in terms of how it's broken down. Like,
generally, we read these substances and none of us can pronounce them. And then you're like, I presume it does something. So he, for instance, says one of them, ligandrol. He says it's the gold standard of anabolic steroids, and it's an extremely efficient steroid. You take it orally, and you can pack on 6 to 8 pounds of lean muscle in an 8-week cycle. So you think, okay. But then he says the other substance he took, he says one of the kind of downsides of taking that steroid, which packs on the muscle. Every time you cough, the microphone explodes, by the way.
Sorry. Apologies.
You're blowing people's ears off.
Sorry.
One of the downsides of that steroid is that it inhibits the production of testosterone in your body. So a medical advisor might tell you to take a testosterone booster, and that's what one of the other substances he took was. So Francis's point is, he says, maybe I've underestimated the intellectual capacity of a young man in his early 20s, but how many of them have the capacity to self-administer a sophisticated program like this? He says, I would have been very surprised if Jianche did not have someone to instruct him what to do, how to do it. And his point is, you know, what about like some kind of plea bargain? Like, if the governing body, if World Rugby really wanted to crack down on this, then sit down with them and say, well, look, he says a 4-year ban for Jianche serves nothing. If the people behind the player are the ones you have to nab, and we don't know who those people are.
Like, it's sort of, when you're reading it, you sort of hope, you're hoping for the sport and for South Africa, or just the legitimacy of it, that this is the fellow who's being caught, and
he's an outlier.
Yeah, but you don't get that sense. When you read this, you don't get the sense that this is the one-off, and this is just you just feel this is the one of maybe a few others who have been caught about it, and that's like, because they go in about the high skills and stuff, and if like that's a long way from professional rugby, like, and if at that age it's sort of almost part of the culture, well then that's a big problem, like.
Yeah, it's a grim picture, Cliona, he paints. What did you make of this piece?
Yeah, it is a grim picture, and then the problem is it leads me to say, well then, is there actually the will to do anything about it? You know, and that's the question for World Rugby, is it, you know, from a league point of view, and then if it's happening in schools, at their grassroots, that this is the culture that's in South Africa at the minute, and it's across all sports, are you actually going to tackle it? Or does nobody really want to tackle it? Because then you're pulling the rug from under sports altogether, because we all like to believe the story. But is the genie out of the bottle now in terms of doping in sport? Everybody's doing it in probably every sport. Are we willing to accept that, or I don't know is the answer, but there's just going to be more and more of these stories.
And is that your sense when you watch most sports? There's just an assumption, well, this is going on to some extent or another. The genie is out of the bottle, well and truly.
Yeah, but I still find you're trying to believe the fairy tale all the time. Put the blinkers on, let's not think about that.
So if you're watching, you know, the 100 metres final next year in Tokyo, will you try and enjoy it on its merits? Because I will sit there cold and say this means absolutely nothing.
Yeah, yeah. I am still in a position where I'm like, you know, there's a fairy tale out there somewhere. You know. Yeah, maybe I'm being optimistic,
but I'm
or
sure
naive.
There is the odd fairy tale out there somewhere.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But
fairy tale suggests it's in the minority.
Yes, but you're watching. So you're watching the Olympics next year. You're watching the athletics, and you're looking at it, and there is that bit of me that's got like, what an athlete, and then you're like, oh, I wonder. Oh, well, just forget it. Move on. You know, you just want to enjoy entertainment versus sport.
Yeah.
It's entertaining to see fast people run down a track.
It's near the start of it. So when you're talking about that, about if like the outlier and all the rest of it, but like the fact that when he so basically he Deontay, he was tested on July the 2nd, in, what year was it?
This year, at
a training camp.
Yeah.
Then the South African media reported that he picked up a hamstring strain on July the 12th. Mm. So he then missed the Rugby Championship campaign, and it was confirmed that he would miss the World Cup because of this hamstring injury. So that's what's put out there in July the 2nd. And then Neil Francis sort of says, well, kind of start thinking, hamstring strain, normally out for 2 to 3 weeks, what's gone? There was really a hamstring strain. Then in late August, the news is broke that he actually tested positive on July the 2nd. Mm. So if we're talking about kind of, do people want to do anything about this? Does it want to change? When he tests positive, the first reaction is, let's hold our hand, we have to just explain now, this is what happened. The first thing is cover up.
Yeah, well, he denied it, and then I think you do have to wait for the B sample.
Mm. Yeah, okay.
So that explains that to a point.
Yeah, but like, well then, but the first instinct there is, it's throw out a dummy line or whatever. It's only when he gets properly caught that they have to come out and say about it. So that sort of makes me, you sort of wonder then, well, hold on.
There's a PR aspect to this.
Yeah, like, and I suppose initially maybe you had to protect them a little bit,
but it's an industry. There's always going to be a PR, isn't
there? Yeah.
It's a business like the money, isn't it?
You could, to play devil's advocate, argue, well, if his A sample was positive and then you threw him to the wolves and said, look what this guy's after doing, and then it turned out there was an issue and his B sample was clean, he might turn around and say,
yeah,
like, could you not have given me a few weeks?
Yeah.
Some level of presumption of innocence.
Now, yeah.
This, you know, you can say, well, yeah, cynically, well, like whatever. That's probably not the issue. Ultimately, at least he was tested and caught. The one thing I'd say, in fairness to them, is at least they're highlighting an issue with steroids in high schools and amongst underage and amateur players.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because they could easily bury that. But they do test at what's called Craven Week, which is...
And it was a state-sponsored one, wasn't it, survey, yeah.
Yeah. They test a bunch of 18-year-olds and 16-year-olds come together in what's called Craven Week for, like, the best players in the country, and they test them all there. Mm. And it became, like, a global story last year when there were a huge number of positive tests. But, I mean, they could have found their way around doing that if they really wanted to, I would say, in their defence. But anyway, that's Neil Francis, page 6 and 7 of the Sunday Independent. He finishes by saying, do we need to put an asterisk beside the winners of the 2019 World Cup?
Well, no, the World Cup's over. I thought it was still going on.
We're all glad it's over. Where do you want to go next? We have some football stuff left with Peter Reid and Souness. We have an interview with two Paralympic athletes. We have David Walsh and the Team Sky thing. Anyone want to jump in on anything in particular?
If we're just sticking with the kind of the theme of solitary confinement or isolation in sport. jump into Shane McGrath's piece, which kind of is the polar opposite of that. Sorry, it wasn't great, was it?
It's good though.
Because it's a good way of just, it's actually a way of linking in, because we were both chatting about it when we were talking about kind of, Shane makes the point himself. It's on page 63.
So this is Katie George Dunleavy and Eve McChrystal, who a lot of people may very well not be familiar with.
I wasn't either. And then you read the piece and you see how we have all the squiggles. It's one of those pieces where you read it and sometimes you read something and it's almost like a drag to keep on going. You feel as if they have to stick with it, whereas with this, it's just, you just keep on going with it because it's so good. Shane makes the point that They are a two-woman counter to the stereotypical image of the lonely athlete whose achievements are built on hours spent in isolated training sessions. The story of Dunleavy and McChrystal is rather a tribute to cooperation, selflessness, and the willingness of two people to sacrifice enormous parts of their lives in pursuit of common glittering goals. Mm.
So they're tandem bike riders.
Yeah.
Say first of all, really people listening going, who are these?
Yeah.
And they won gold in the Paralympic Games.
Yeah, 2016, gold and silver.
2016,
gold in the time trial, silver in the road race. And then they were double world champions 2017, 2018.
2018.
So they backed that up for the next 2 years.
And obviously it's 10 months out then from Tokyo. It's got personal interest story element to it. Like, there's the great picture of when they they see that they've won the time trial. The picture, and it's like the picture almost will define their career almost in the sense of that great moment of relief. And then McChrystal says, "I hate that photograph."
She says she looks
horrible in it. And it's good because obviously he's chatting to the two of them. So it's one of them where, not, as when you're interviewing someone, sometimes I think it's almost good when you can get a couple of sports people together who naturally will just bounce off each other. Like, you'll get an honesty and a kind of familiarity between the two of them and an understanding they'll bring to a conversation with each other that you can maybe get difficult if it's just one-on-one. Yeah. Mm. And that's what's good about this as well, like kind of, which I'm guessing Shane has been clever with, where he's let them kind of go off and use it together, and then he's throwing a couple of bits in, and it's just a great, it's just a very good story, and it's the power of sport and what they can do for a young child who has a disability at a young age, and then kind of...
And there's a bit about funding people. too at the end, you know, that they couldn't have done it if she didn't get funding from Sport Ireland, and you've got a 42-year-old woman with a family and a 39-year-old partially sighted woman, you know, so there's a lot in that, you know, in terms of what we consider elite sport and
what's worth funding, what's not.
Well, exactly. Back around Stephen Kenny's type thing, you know.
Mm. And I think Dunleavy only took up cycling in 2011, that's an interesting point as well, a little bit, where these aren't two young people, great athletes who have been moulded from such a young age. It's like people have come together at a certain stage in their life and maybe might never have envisaged something like this ever happening to them.
Yeah.
And then you have two people who are just brought together by Neil Delahaye, the national development coach with Cycling Ireland. And then, it's just a good story in that, where kind of, not out of nowhere, obviously they've been brought together, but where they can just kind of like blossom together, and it's two people who are clearly can bounce off each other and are very good for each other in that professional sense, and aren't then kind of solid people for them.
It's Dunleavy, by the way, who's partially sighted. She was diagnosed at 11. Yeah. So she's behind McChrystal on the bike.
Yeah, she provides the power, I think.
Yeah, and McChrystal, she's my eyes as well, as much as anything. And McChrystal's from Dundalk, and she's a guard and a mother of two.
Yeah.
So it's a great pairing, and they're going to go for Tokyo again.
One of the pairs of quotes, which I'll just read out because it's very, very poignant, is it's from Katie Jorres, where she says, I got into sport when I was a teenager. It was due to opportunities. I got an encouragement. I had quite low self-esteem before that, and sport was a way for me to find confidence through finding something that I was good at. I was diagnosed at the age of 11. Before that, I struggled. I thought I couldn't do anything. I didn't realise that I couldn't see, which in itself by a sentence is mad to think. I thought I could see the same as everyone else. When I was diagnosed then, even though it was devastating news, it made me realise why I struggled. But I struggled with the news because I didn't want to be different. And then she was given help at school. But just that kind of just explains where, you know, I think it was Jack McCaffrey said it after the All-Ireland, where he was talking about the power of sport and how sport can be important. People kind of brush it aside, it's only a game of football, or it's only this, or it's only that. But like when she was, for that young girl, like when she was 11, it helped her, I would imagine, get through that period in her life where she was able to kind of focus on this and maybe didn't feel different, or was able to actually feel, kind of get away from those feelings of low self-esteem.
Back to the Katie Taylor discussion, was she just escaping life? It's all a few different sides of the same coin, isn't it?
Yeah.
So good luck to them. That's a really good piece. I haven't seen them interviewed in many places down the years. Shane McGrath with Dunleavy and McChrystal. Because I know the Peter Reid interview is really good. A lot of people really like Peter Reid. Just to sum up what David Walsh is saying, without getting too into Team Sky, because I think people do have a little bit of fatigue with Team Sky.
Yeah.
But basically, just to let you know what's happened here, there's an official inquiry now to find out what the hell has been going on at Team Sky. And one that went on this week was the Medical Practitioners Tribunal Service. They're basically getting stuck into Dr. Richard Freeman, who was the doctor with Team Sky, and whether or not he's fit to practice. So one of the big controversies of Team Sky down the years was that 30 sachets of Testo gel arrived in Manchester at the base in 2011. So after various no-shows and rigmarole the whole way through, Mary O'Rourke, who's the QC for Richard Freeman, was talking at the tribunal during the week. And Dave Walsh says Shane Sutton, he's the former head coach of Team Sky, one-time performance director of British Cycling, could not have been much amused at the discussion that took place at the tribunal in Manchester 2 days ago. According to Mary O'Rourke, the QC for Dr. Richard Freeman, in the Fit to Practice case, the reason her client ordered 30 sachets of Testo gel in 2011 was to treat Sutton's erectile dysfunction. Walsh writes, forget for a moment that testosterone is not something any reputable physician would prescribe for erectile dysfunction, and consider the conversation from Sutton's point of view. He wasn't present when people were publicly discussing his sexual capabilities. He later denied that he suffers from erectile dysfunction. As for the testosterone delivery to the headquarters of British Cycling and Team Sky, he says he didn't even know it was ordered. Whereas Dr. Freeman is saying that Sutton bullied him into ordering the testosterone to help with his erectile dysfunction. What in the name of God is going on here with this lot? Like, this is now... I just can't even believe that this has been... So there's a QC involved here, there's Dr. Richard Freeman, and it is their understanding that Shane Sutton bullied them to order testosterone for his erectile dysfunction. They've said this at a tribunal, and Shane Sutton says, well, one, you know, not to get into the man's privacy too much, I don't suffer from that condition.
Just on the record.
Yeah, just want to put that out there. Yeah. A bit like Pele when he was doing the ads for erectile dysfunction. Now, if I did suffer from it. But two, that, this is not true, according to Shane Sutton. And Walsh outlines the various other bigger questions and says, like, we're going to have to get to the bottom of this because it's just a bit ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole thing is in complete disrepute, but that one
It just sort of...
It's grasping at straws, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or, yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm trying to think what the right analogy is, but there's...
I was trying to think of something really clever to say there. I wasn't able to.
It's a limp excuse. Are we saying that?
You can, yeah.
Right. Anyway, that's what's going on at Team Sky. It's ridiculous. Peter Reid, you liked?
Yeah. I actually saw this last night, and then it's in the because it was from the Observer. It's on Os Inlo, page two. It's a good interview. Like, it kind of, it's basically there's a film coming out about Howard Kendall, about Everton.
And their golden years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and Andy Hunter is speaking to Peter Reid. I'll just try out one personal story real quick about Peter Reid. I had a brief experience with him last year when I went to Wigan's training ground. I was doing an interview with Alan Moore.
Mm-hmm.
This fella, he came in late to the meet and puts his feet up, and then, like, the lads are going through everything. And do you know when you just get a sense of you're in the presence of someone who is just, like, brilliant? Or just where, I don't know, it's like, you know what, like, I don't think I've ever really had it, actually. I don't think where it's just like this fella, he just carried himself where you're like, I actually just want to, like, follow you around a little bit, like.
Okay.
You know what I mean? He just had something about him. I don't know what it was. Like, he put his feet up. Like,
that's what you're saying about Joe.
I know. Yeah.
I just sipped.
That's what I got.
You're raging out in the middle.
I know, because it was 8 o'clock in the morning. Won't lie, a couple of us were a small bit hungover. Yeah. You're going through...
So your judgment was questionable.
Yeah, but you're going through, like, the Wigan lads, the stats lads and his coaching staff, Paul Cook, who used to manage Sligo Rovers, who was going through this in-depth analysis of kind of, they're playing Norwich, and then Peter Reid just rocks in, and you just don't realise when you're in the presence of greatness. Like, he just has something about him. It's a spark, like, even at that age, where he just has something about him. And he was good crack. He had a bit of salmon and scrambled eggs with him.
But, so was it just his body language, demeanour, or was it something he said, the way he carried himself?
Like, of course, it was just.
I've never heard you give such a glowing tribute to anyone. So I'm curious.
He just rocked in. Like, it's hard to describe. He just rocked in, and
he's small. So it's not like he walked in and dominated the room.
But he just sort of just had a presence about him, and you're kind of like, at first I was like, I should have done my proper research, because at first I was like, what's Peter Reid doing here?
Yeah.
And then I copped that he's actually involved with...
Director
with,
of football.
Yeah, with Wigan. I didn't realise that, because at first I was like, is he just wandering off the street or something? but then I realised there's a few scouts there, like Joe Royal's involved. Sorry, that's gone off on a tangent.
Did you talk to him much?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Do you think he liked you?
No, probably not. He's probably thinking, who is this? Because I was there to interview Alan Moore, and I was asking him a few bits, and... Yeah, well, I hope he sort of remembers.
I'm actually quite taken this. We'll come back to Peter Reid. This is incredible.
But, yeah,
you've met a lot of impressive footballers, but it's Peter Reid.
And do you know what I actually said to him? Because I met him once before when I was about 13, and I was 12, and I was in Florida, and he was at an outlet in Orlando. And
what did 12-year-old David think of Peter then?
No, my dad told me who he was.
Okay.
I didn't know who he was.
Okay.
And then, but the piece is very good. Like, sorry, I got off on there. It's just interesting because he actually has donated a bit of money to Carol Cadwallader. Is that her name? The journalist who kind of broke into Cambridge Analytica. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't expect, again, this is another reason why people should like Peter Day as well, is that, like, he's not just in, like, one-dimensional. He's a smart fellow, like, you know, and talks about kind of fronting up against Boris Johnson at a charity match.
That's brilliant, yeah.
Before the Brexit stuff, he knew when, have I got news for you? We're kind of just having him on, thinking he was great crack. He knew this fellow was dangerous, you know.
Well, and, this is a great little passage. This is 2006. Yeah. So Reid's doing some England Legends team in a charity match at Reading, and Johnson's there. And this is when Johnson's editor of The Spectator.
Yeah.
And famously, he stood over. He had that article which said that Liverpoolians had wallowed in their victim status, and that he repeated the lie. This is 2006 now, to be having this, standing over this, that drunken fans shared a responsibility in the deaths of those at Hillsborough. So somehow Peter Reid ends up with Boris Johnson on his charity team. And he says that he'd had a go at my city, certain individual football fans, so I told him in no uncertain terms what I thought of him. And thankfully, Andy Hunter, the journalist, says, what was that? I told him he was a fat, lying twat and a disgrace for what he wrote about my city. Cowardly, says Reid, he shit himself. So this is the kind of good stuff you're getting from Peter Reid about Johnson. The man's a proven liar, and he's refused to apologise in the House of Commons when various MPs have asked him to. So that's one snap of Peter Reid. Do you like him, Cliona, as much as David, or do you have a more rational
sense? Not as much as David.
Who does?
I don't know if anyone does.
No, his wife doesn't like him.
But I mean, it is like you say, when you get all these little snapshots, he does come across as a man of sort of integrity and that bit of charisma and personality and all of that, which
is for them as well.
Is always nice to see, and a bit of spark in what he says. You know?
Like if he was still a manager now, and I was involved, people would read this, and the first thing people would say was, "Oh, we'll just stick to football," because he talks about the reference. So he talks about kind of the stuff about Cambridge Analytica. He mentions about Aaron Banks, and he's talking about like Steve Bannon and all. He's talking about like Brexit. And
I thought the Brexit referendum was corrupt. I voted Remain. Yeah. Even now, we're still discussing what it involves. A referendum is democracy, yes, but we didn't know the facts or what anyone else was voting for. Anyone who says they did is a liar, or else they're Einstein. And I don't see many Einsteins out there.
Yeah. Yeah, like it's.
But that's that sort of like, he seems like a very intelligent, well-rounded man who can just see. Very rational talk. Well, that's actually rubbish, and that's PR, and that's whatever. And we'll call people out on that.
Yeah. And even on the football side of things, like, he's like Souness. We know we talk about Souness. Like, a lot of these lads get slagged for just talking sense. Like, it's almost as if now when you're talking about football, you have to show how smart you are and how you understand the game. Whereas, like, he just talks here, he says, the modern game is different and the players are wealthy boys. There's nothing wrong with that. It's more corporate now, and the game is big business, big brands all over the world. But it all still comes down to winning football matches. These lads have to win them and show desire. I want to see more. He's talking about the current Everton team. Mm. I've played for and managed big clubs, and Everton is the only place to be. Goodison's going to go, but it'll still be Everton Football Club, and there will still be the desire to win things. He talks about desire, hope and passion.
Yeah.
You can never lose that. And like Souness going into that, that's football, you know what I mean? Sometimes, like, I know sometimes it's nice to be able to, for fellas to explain different elements of a game, but at the same time, like, you see Roy Keane getting kind of slaughtered for coming out with some sound bites by people who, other journalists online, and you're sort of thinking, well, no, this is why these lads are so good. Sometimes it's just cutting through the nonsense and actually seeing the game straight. Like, Graham Souness is in the Sunday Times today, and he picks out Fabinho, you know? And you're reading that and you're saying, that's so simple, because he's just talking sense. He's talking in the simplest form, because that's all he has to explain. He doesn't have to go into kind of elements of, well, this is why in this phase of play he was three quarters over here. He just explains why he's so good, and you're reading it and you understand it. And it's almost like, I'm understanding it, so it's so simple. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, he gets slaughtered. Souness gets slaughtered for speaking sense about Paul Pogba. Like, the insinuation, everyone knows what people are insinuating about him when he talks about him. But he's dead right. Like, he speaks about Fabinho, and he's dead right. So, like, it's almost when, like, these sort of fellas speak just in simple form, and it's almost as if people don't want to hear it like that. They want to almost be, I don't know, maybe I'm going off one, but, like...
I know what you're saying.
And there's no harm in that, and that there about kind of desire, hope and passion. Like, when Roy Keane talks about the two sports fullbacks being dumb and dumber, he's right, like, they're out of position all the time. They make stupid mistakes.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just have to point out the obvious.
Yeah.
But sometimes people don't want to do it.
But isn't that what they say about really smart people can take complex things and distill it down to just key sentences?
Yeah.
You know, and even this, like, the modern game is different, and so there's a ration or a a realism there, that it's now big and corporate, it's a different animal altogether, but the simplistic piece of it is it's still 11v11, you got to win the game. Mm. And to do that, you got to have desire, whatever the motivation is, and maybe sometimes maybe that balance does exist, that we don't have to get caught up in the big brand side of things. It's still a game of football. It's a game.
Yeah. What was Jim Gavin saying during the week about kind of, or some talk where he's talking about players now, they don't want to be told exactly that. It was a good point he was making where, like, they want to kind of figure stuff out themselves and whatever on the pitch. But then at the same time, for them to do that, they have to have those basic cores of wanting to do it or wanting to actually go to extra. Yeah. They have to have that in them, like the Dubs or any top team. You can be a great player and you can do unbelievable things, but unless you're actually willing to work a little bit harder than the fella you're playing against, it doesn't matter. Like.
Just one other last thing you brought up, and I'd say, Cliona, you can appreciate that in particular, having played team sports at a high level as well. They're having a reunion, the 85 winning team. Like, they were unbelievable, Everton, but you know, you can forget 84 to 87, two league titles, FA Cup, European Cup Winners' Cup. So the video, the new DVD, Herod's Way, is about all that. But they're having a reunion tomorrow, the 85 team, and he says, "It's a word that doesn't come out amongst players when we get together, but it's love. That's the nice part of it. There is a love there, and you can't beat love. Even now when we meet up, it's something I look forward to, and it was a long, long time ago, but it's still there. We all met in the Hilton before Howard's funeral, and it was emotional, but it was also warm. I was speaking at the funeral, so I said I wouldn't drink, although Andy Gray insisted the gaffer would want me to drink, so of course I did." People going about the party time we were dedicated to, but it's kind of nice to have a man in his 70s openly saying we all love each other as men and we're the, you know, the companionship and all that stuff. And you'd kind of know, I'd say, you know, the team you won the All-Ireland with, when you get together now, similar situation.
Well, that's the thing about team sport, isn't it? You're chasing. So if you're with any athlete, is going to have that big ambition, that big drive. But if you're doing that with, if you're talking about GAA, with 30 other people, you know, and you're all pushing each other on, and you end up dragging people out at really difficult times on and off the field, and they do it for you. And whether you like them or not, there's a sort of a communal commitment to this. And you see, I guess you see your teammates at their best and their worst.
There's a vulnerability. You're exposed, I think.
Yeah, you're absolutely exposed. And when you're looking for small margins and you're striving to do something excellent, people are going to fall short at different times, so you are absolutely exposed. And then you kind of don't forget that, you know. And you may not be, like, let's say my teammates, maybe four or five that I'd be really close to now, but there's still a connection with all the others.
Yes,
you know,
shared experience.
Shared experience and some really wonderful times. And
would you, having gone through, you know, so two All-Stars, winning an All-Ireland with the Dublin Footballers, female environment, and now you're at an elite inter-county male hurling environment, is there anything which jumps out at you in the dynamics, that sense of love, that sense of a companionship, a team operating together, that jumps out, or is it pretty similar terrain in both?
I suppose the difference is, do you know what, it is still that in really good teams there's always that sense of companionship, and there's that sense of honesty, I think, in terms of the really good ones have that trust where you know not everyone's going to be fantastic every day. So if I see someone come into the dressing room, I can be honest enough to say, here, listen, you're falling a little bit short today. You pull up your socks and I'll help you do it.
It's player-driven, is it?
And there is that honesty in it. And that's there in male and female. The biggest difference, really, with male and female dressing room, it's not ambition, it's not that, but it's just the language of the... It's a different language. You know, in male dressing rooms, it's still driven by strength and power and that warrior
it's
sense.
Stuck into them.
All of that. Yeah. You know, and it's a little bit more aggressive, just in the narrative and the language they use sometimes, you know. Mm. And you don't get the same language in female dressing rooms, but that doesn't mean that it's any less ambitious, it's just slightly different.
Different emphasis.
In how they motivate themselves and in how they, the words they use. The outcome is the same, the commitment is the same, just maybe the how they get there is different.
It was good, I was at the PFA Ireland Awards last night in the Marker Hotel, and Sean Hoare, the Dundalk centre-back, he was one of the players in the team of the year, and he was making the point that in the Dundalk dressing room, he was truthful, he was like, the manager almost has an easy job, because in that dressing room, it's like what Cliona was saying, if a player's not doing it, if a player turns up late, 5 minutes late, the players in the dressing room are the ones that sort it out. The manager doesn't have to get bogged down with those sort of things. It's sort of, it's done within that dressing room, and that's what drives that. And then Vinnie Perrett, who got the Manager of the Year award, in fairness, he made the same point. He was like, it's almost easy sometimes going into work with his staff because he knows he doesn't have to worry about little crappy things that kind of can become petty and maybe kind of fester a little bit, like kind of timekeeping or just... Because it's always like, I imagine, like the small things, like in any walk of life, the small things that kind of build and build and build, whereas those things are just cut out before they can even go any further by the players. And I'd imagine, like any successful dressing room, that's how it has to be, like, you know. Like, the manager, obviously, that ultimately at the top of it, but, like, doesn't have to worry about stuff that a group of players who want the same thing will be willing to dig each other out over, you know.
Yeah, manager can't be on top of everything. You know, you need the players to pull each other along, don't you? Anyway, that's Peter Reid. So that's in the Observer as well. And Everton fans, it's called Herod's Way, that new film about Everton in the 80s. So that's going to be released tomorrow. Hopefully worth a watch. We're pretty much done. I've kept you long enough here. Jeez, long day. It feels like a long time ago since we started off with Stephen Kenny. Is there anything else you want to point someone towards? Or have we kind of covered the book?
Just, obviously Liverpool are playing Man City today.
Yeah.
There's obviously a few bits in all the papers about it, but I was just reading Roy Curtis' piece on page 84, and I'll just read a few paragraphs, if that's all right. It's like...
Absolutely, yeah.
It's the intro, so it's like the Beatles and Abbey Road, Liverpool's Fab Four are at a crossing, one which is successfully negotiated, will yield an iconic image to endure beyond all their days. 50 years on from John, Paul, George and Ringo's classic album cover, Jürgen, Mo, Virgil and Sadio can deliver their own immortal freeze frame, a snapshot for the ages. Victory over Manchester City today will carry the House of Shankly to the other side of the Avenue of Achievement. It will represent a crossing of the sporting Rubicon. It will announce Anfield, even with the season not a tour complete, as home of the champions elect. Fingers crossed Man City win 5-0.
You can't stomach that, can you not?
Good piece of writing, but... No, thanks.
Okay, no thanks. Cian O'Connor, thanks so much for coming in. And David Snaid, journalist, and Peter Reid's biggest fan, it turns out, as well. Thank you for coming out. Good man. That's the paper review. Back next Sunday.
That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.